Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning, and you are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger with Mark Brody and Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour on the show, we sit down with Ruben Gallego, who's running to keep his seat in Congress, and our monsoon series continues as we head to the zoo. But first, last night's monsoon storm left thousands of Valley residents without power, some roads closed due to flooding, trees uprooted. It's also left a kind of haze over the Phoenix metro area that you might see if you're driving right now. And with us to talk about that is Matt Pace. He is a meteorologist with the State Department of Environmental Quality. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this haze. What is this? Is this due to the rain?
This is due to the dust that moved through yesterday. So there were some strong to severe thunderstorms just to the north and northeast of the valley. They produced winds of 60 miles per hour as they swept down from the northeast down towards the southwest, picked up a lot of dust in kind of the land right between Mesa and Fountain Hills that swept into the valley. And then since everywhere didn't get rain, we actually saw that dust move around, and now you are left with this haze this morning. The winds are calm out there, so we're going to have to get some heating today. And then we should start to see that haze lift just a little bit, but it is still going to be very hazy throughout the whole day.
Yeah. Am I wrong in thinking we've had a lot of days like this recently? It seems like more than usual, but maybe I'm just cranky about it.
It has been unique, and you're not cranky at all. So we don't normally see these come out of the northeast. We've now had two pretty large dust storms move right out of the northeast into the valley. Typically, when we see those wind patterns, you don't have a lot of dust that you can generate from those winds to blow into the valley, but it's been so dry in those regions that you have been able to pick that up. Plus, we were active in that kind of that middle part of July, and then it got really warm. We had temperatures over 110 degrees, some record heat. That allowed all that soil to dry back out. Pinal County dried out. So any wind that we get, it just kicks up the dust. So you're not kind of complaining about the dust. It is out there for sure.
Matt, I'm curious about sort of the localized nature of some of these storms. And it seems like in one part of the valley can get torrential downpours, and just a few miles away, you know, maybe some strong winds and some dust, but no rain. What is it about this region that causes, you know, these sort of localized storms from night to night?
And that's really the fun and also for a lot of people disappointing part of the monsoon, especially when you're a forecaster, because you are right. There can be a huge difference just in a couple miles. I pulled some rain gauge data from the flood control, and 43rd Ave Peoria so far this year, this monsoon, has received 2.13 inches of rain. Just down the road at 83rd Avenue in Peoria, just over a half inch of rain.
Wow.
So that shows you how spotty that these storms can be. And the reason for that, and you can watch this happen on radar, you have these outflow winds move through. Those are the winds generated by the thunderstorm. And where those typically collide in the valley, you'll instantly get those thunderstorms start to form. And then they only really last 10 to 15 minutes at most sometimes. So they drop all their rain, and then the next storm may kind of form downwind a little bit from that particular one. So you don't oftentimes see the entire valley get that wetting rain. Instead, it's those very isolated spots because there's so much happening in the atmosphere to make that small isolated storm develop.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so monsoon season so far, we were promised at the beginning of the season a lot of rain. How's it going? Are we adding up?
So officially at Sky Harbor, we're just below an inch of rain so far. So not terrible. The average for the season is 2.71 inches. So we still have until September 30th to get that. It looks like it'll be active today, tomorrow, and into the weekend before we dry out just a little bit. But other parts of the valley, we just mentioned how spotty it is. Fountain Hills has seen about 3.5 inches of rain so far this year for the monsoon. Mesa, around 1.5 to 2 inches. Surprise, Sun City also seeing about 2.5 inches. The Southeast Valley not actually faring quite as well. They're only about an inch of rain. So even though the official observation is 0.91 at Sky Harbor, some parts of the valley certainly have seen their fair share of rain.
And Matt, before we let you go, I want to ask you about last night's storm, because it seemed like the winds were particularly strong and particularly damaging, especially in the East Valley where we are here. Was that a significant storm in terms, or maybe stronger than other storms we've seen this season?
It was certainly a significant storm. Those were very strong thunderstorms over Fountain Hills. And to give you an idea of how big those were, they were about 50 to 55,000 feet high. So commercial jetliners normally fly between 30 and 32,000 feet. So just think of how high those storms were.
Wow.
And then you have all that moisture up in there. And when it evaporates, it creates cold air that drops out of those storms. And you get those very strong winds out ahead. So even I live in Mesa, our visibility due to the dust dropped to about a quarter mile or less.
Wow.
Easily had winds of 40, 50 miles per hour. And you can get those very strong winds when you have storms that are that high up into the atmosphere.
All right. That is Matt Pace, a meteorologist with the State Department of Environmental Quality. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Attorneys for Texas and six other states told a federal judge in Houston yesterday that they'll continue to incur irreparable harm if the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or DACA program isn't ended right away. This follows another federal judge's ruling last week ordering the Trump administration to continue the program. With me to talk about what happened inside the Houston courtroom yesterday in that case is Julian Aguilar, border and immigration affairs reporter for the Texas Tribune. And Julian, can you sort of set the stage for us? What was this case about and how does it fit in with some of the other cases dealing with DACA, including the one last week out of D.C.?
Well, you're correct. This was one of the several lawsuits regarding the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. But this one was actually filed to stop the program. You made a reference to the other lawsuits. There are currently three different decisions that have been handed down over the last few months that all keep DACA in place in one form or another. Last week's decision by the D.C. judge upheld an earlier order that he gave, pretty much mandating that the government should start processing new DACA applications and renewals. That was probably the most far-reaching decision that we've had. So what happened Wednesday in Houston was the state of Texas and nine other states' attorneys general signed on to a lawsuit to compel the Trump administration to stop DACA. Obviously, President Trump said in September of 2017 that he was going to phase out the program, and then those various lawsuits followed, which mandated that he had to keep it going. So the state of Texas got impatient. The state of Texas was the first state to sue to end the 2014 Obama-era deferred action for parents of children, the better known as the DAPA Act. So they thought they'd try their luck and try to get DACA, the 2012 initiative, also, you know, written off the books. What attorneys for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, MALDEF, said mainly was that Texas can't show irreparable harm because they waited 6 years to file a lawsuit.
How did Texas counter that? I mean, what is the state's argument for doing away with DACA?
Well, the state's argument, in one respect, they said that they waited so long because they had their hands tied with the 2014 DAPA lawsuit, which was eventually enjoined by the same federal district judge, Judge Andrew Hanen, in 2015. And that went to the Fifth Circuit. It went all the way to the Supreme Court in 2016. So they said, you know, they were concentrating on that. And they also said that they were encouraged because President Trump said about a year ago now that he was going to phase out DACA. So they saw no need to file suit. And it was only until these three various court decisions that compelled the Department of Justice to keep the program alive that they thought that they'd take their own individual separate action to have this taken off the books. And what attorneys for MALDEF and the Attorney General's Office for the state of New Jersey was granted permission to be an intervener in the case, they argued that Texas pretty much doesn't have standing. And they also argued that Judge Hanen ruling, agreeing with the state of Texas that this program should be enjoined, would throw all these legal decisions from various district courts, that it would pretty much create chaos. And Judge Hanen actually was pretty critical of that assessment, saying, well, you know, you have a D.C. court that vacated the memo to rescind DACA. You have a California court, a New York court that said you have to keep the program alive with respect to renewals. You have another one that said you have to keep the program alive with respect to new applications. You have a decision that came out of Maine that says, no, you can do away with the program in that state. So you already have conflicting opinions. So what does one more matter?
Does it seem safe to say that whichever side loses here will appeal?
Oh, yes. No, I think it's definitely very safe to say that. And attorneys for MALDEF have been on the record as saying that Texas filed suit hoping that Judge Hanen will grant their request for a preliminary injunction, which, again, would throw all these different legal decisions in to sort of this whole disarray, and the state of Texas and the Department of Justice would be able to argue, look, we have a California court telling us to do one thing, now we have a Texas court telling us to do another thing, so we need an appellate court to tell us what to do once and for all. And what everybody is assuming, I think rightfully so, is that this is eventually going to end up between the nine justices at the Supreme Court of the United States.
Does it seem significant in any way that this case is being heard by the same judge who, as you referenced, basically struck down the DAPA program?
Oh, I think it's definitely significant. I think in 2014, Texas was accused of, you know, shopping for a judge that might be sympathetic to their arguments. Judge Hainan, he presided over dozens and dozens of lawsuits with respect to the border fence that began under the Bush administration. He's presided over various immigration cases. He's been on record in his opinions and his public statements admonishing the former administration for their border security policies. So I think it is significant. They could have filed suit in Travis County, obviously, right? I mean, the state of Texas, the Attorney General's office is located in Travis County. They could have filed suit there, but they instead chose to file suit in Brownsville. Granted, you know, there wasn't 100% chance they were going to get Judge Hainan because there are several judges down there, but they took their chance and they got a judge that did exactly what they wanted a few years ago. And I think that's what they're hoping is going to happen in the next couple weeks.
All right. That's Julian Aguilar, border and immigration affairs reporter for the Texas Tribune. Julian, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Research into Valley fever has been ongoing for decades and significant advances have been made. But the fungal disease is primarily found in Arizona and the Central Valley of California, including Bakersfield. And that limited coverage area may be the reason there hasn't been enthusiastic support among lawmakers to increase funding that could ultimately lead to a vaccine. But that may be changing. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy represents that area of California, where frequent cases of Valley fever are reported. And he's introduced H.R. 6562, or the Forward Act, to bring a total of $95 million in research funding for Valley fever and other fungal diseases. And with me to talk about the legislation and what could be next is Dr. John Galgiani, director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence. Dr. Galgiani, what are the highlights of this proposed legislation?
Well, this is actually pretty historic, actually, in that Kevin McCarthy, whose home district is the Central Valley of California, the Kern County, Bakersfield area.
And he's majority leader at this point.
And he's majority leader. It's no coincidence that when he came to Congress, he brought this interest in Valley fever with him. Because the constituents in his home district really want something done about that, and he formed a task force and co-chaired with David Schweikert several years ago, and as a result of those consultations and discussions, expanding it to many other Congress people, they have now arrived at this bill that they've set before Congress, and it's to increase our understanding about this disease with research, but also there's a lot of meat there in terms of trying to promote translational work, that is getting better drugs to people who need them, and eventually actually to see if we can prevent this disease entirely with a vaccine.
Why has that been a struggle so far? When you consider that, I know it's really focused on a couple of states, but one of them is California. And Arizona, I think our footprint in terms of Congress is growing and growing. It seems like this would be a pretty important issue for people to take up.
You'd think so. And in fact, it turns out that 2/3 of all Valley fever infections in the country occur in Arizona. And 80% of those are right here in Maricopa County. And it's pretty much mostly up and down I-10 between Tucson, where I live, and Phoenix. So it's very concentrated, and it's the impact actually of Valley fever on us and the constituents that are at risk of this is very similar to the impact of polio prior to there being a vaccine. The only difference is this is a very concentrated, small geographic area compared to the worldwide impact of polio. And that actually is part of the reason I think that Valley fever hasn't gotten too much respect, because if you think of it as a national problem, it is really an orphan disease. It's less than 200,000 prevalence. And so it's a small problem, even though the impact is really very large on us.
Now, the legislation is focused on short, medium, and long-term goals. The long-term goal is a vaccine. And I know in the past you've been involved with a vaccine or something close to a vaccine. When it comes down to the ultimate solving of this problem, is a vaccine possible? Is a vaccine the best way to solve the problem?
it's been a driver for research since the 1950s. Because so many people, after they get over their valley fever, are immune for the rest of their lives. So the idea that you could make a vaccine has always been sort of plausible. In fact, we now have a vaccine candidate that is very likely on a track to be a usable vaccine for dogs. The NIH has awarded us, we're now in the second of 4 years, that's matched by some business capital. A company called Anavive is also contributing support, and it's very likely this vaccine candidate will be available to dog owners in maybe 4 or 5 years. If that's the case, and if it really works as well as we hope it does, there really is no reason it couldn't also move to humans. It's just a much bigger step to take it from a USDA-approved veterinary vaccine to a human. So I think it's within reach, but you get into the problem of this being a very small market. And vaccines, you know, you think about what is a vaccine market. I mean, I think of 25, 35 million people as a big number, but a vaccine market is billions of people. I mean, who gets tetanus shots, for example? Everybody in the world, right? That's a market for vaccines, influenza vaccines. So the idea of finding a manufacturer interested in investing in what it would take to get a vaccine to help us, that's the challenge. And you can make a very good public health argument for this. We kind of use a number of $500 million per year impacting those small areas where this disease happens.
So this came up in the statement that was put out by Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who we've referenced already, that there's a growing number of cases that they're seeing in Kern County, where Bakersfield is. With an increasing number of cases, are we seeing that because of the weather causing certain things, whatever it may be? Or is it because folks like you are able to identify the disease better? People are getting tested for it more. Is it a case of information or something else?
I think it's multiple factors. There's year-to-year variation, and I think that's really related to weather. You may remember 2011 was all-time high for Arizona. We had 16,000 cases reported. It then no one noticed that it then dropped 50% over the next couple of years, which that year-to-year variation is probably related to rainfall patterns. And I think one of the major factors in the long trend of growth over the last 20 years is population explosion in the areas where the fungus is. And Bakersfield has some of that, but in fact, and perhaps part of the reason why the community of Bakersfield is so mobilized around this disease is they actually grew up here. We have so many people who have moved to Phoenix and never heard of valley fever until they get it, or a friend of theirs had it, or their dog gets it. And whereas in Bakersfield, they pretty much everyone has a story to tell, either of themselves or somebody they know who had a really bad case. And they've translated that into telling their elected officials that we want to do something about it.
Dr. John Galgiani is director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence. Always good to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Early ballots are arriving in mailboxes, and Arizona's primary elections are less than a month away. In advance of that, we've been inviting in the candidates running in contested races to talk about why they're running and some of the key issues in their contests.
You know, it's been 24 years since Arizona has had an educator at the helm of the Department of Education.
I am a proud American Muslim woman.
That although our election system is the greatest in the world, it is still far from perfect.
We need more options for our young people, more counselors, more social workers.
Common Core's been repealed by the State Board of Ed, and now we have new standards.
And we know what's possible if we keep moving forward.
The current shortcomings of the office have left our system vulnerable to cyber attacks.
We're gonna fly, fight, and win on Election Day with your help.
Today, Ruben Gallego. The 7th District Democratic Congressman is running for re-election to his third term in office. He's being challenged in the primary by former state lawmaker Catherine Miranda. Gallego has become known for being very public in his criticism of President Trump. And when he stopped by the KJZZ studios, my first question was about whether his responsibilities as a congressman have been affected by the president's actions and comments.
Well, I think it certainly plays into what my duties are as a member of Congress. We are supposed to be a check and balance against the executive. And unfortunately, I think that this Congress has not actually done that. I think Paul Ryan and Republicans in Congress have not actually stood up to the president. And that's why I believe it is my job, even though I am in the minority, to be as vocal as possible to really encourage people to help stop what I think are just some overextensions by this executive.
Let's go to some issues. Obviously, immigration is a huge issue, mm-hmm. whether undocumented or not. We have heard that a great percentage of Democrats, even a pretty good percentage of Republicans, want to support the so-called Dreamers, but we haven't seen anything come into play. How big a role does that play at this point in terms of at least good faith negotiation on immigration?
Well, I think right now what you do see within Congress, both the Senate and the House, you do see some understanding that we need to take care of this. We definitely need to fix the situation with Dreamers to make sure they are not deported or eligible for deportation. The problem you have there is I think you have the House and the Senate that can come up with a bipartisan solution. No one's going to get everything they want, and that's fine. That's part of negotiating. But the problem that we have is that every time the Democrats or Republicans go and talk to the president, he's all over the place. We have no idea where he's going to be. One day he'll say that, yes, I'm totally with you. I'll support you guys on your immigration bill. And then the next day he'll just pull the rug right from under us. And that makes it very difficult to keep good faith negotiations going with Republicans because they are afraid that whatever they negotiate, the president may turn on them later. And that makes it very difficult.
You mentioned people never get exactly what they want. In an ideal world for you, what would your priorities be for immigration reform?
Ideal world would be very simple. Everyone that's in this country right now, go through a background check. You are going to pay a fine because you should pay a fine. You have entered this country without permission. And then we're going to put you in line, like everybody else, to become a legal permanent resident and eventually a citizen. Now, I don't believe, like other people, this needs to take 20 years. I think we should actually even make it easier for people to become legal permanent residents and citizens in this country because that would actually deter people from coming in here illegally. That's it. You know, we just make it very, very simple. And to make sure in the future we don't have these huge populations of people that are here undocumented, mm-hmm. we make it easier for people to get worker visas in this country. And we find companies that are abusing a lot of this workforce when we know legally they can get it either by paying higher wages to get the workforce need or go get the visas they need to actually bring in that workforce.
If we get away from the wall itself, mm-hmm. let's say after what you've said about doing background checks on folks already here, what does additional border security look like to you? Do we have to have additional border security?
So I actually don't think we need to have additional border security. We've actually put, you know, the border security is now, for example, Border Patrol is the largest federal law enforcement in this country. If we want to stop the opioids coming in over the border or heavy drugs coming over, we actually need to have more custom officers with better technology to stop all the transfer of drugs that are coming from the south. And that they come in big, huge trucks or in little cars, but we need to have more people actually checking that. The secondary thing is, again, for those that are coming over and just trying to find work, if we just make it legal for them to do it, I think we'd have a lot less opportunity. We'd have a lot less people trying to cross the border illegally. These human beings are paying $20,000 to coyotes to take them across the border. Why don't we, as a country, say, give us $20,000, pass a quick background check, and here you go. Here's a 5-year work permit. After those 5 years, if you've done well, you haven't messed up, then maybe we'll move you into a legal permanent residency. Let's do that instead of creating this like black market for people when we could be essentially bringing in a lot more tax dollars and a lot of very valuable workforce, whether it's with their hands or with their brains.
Mm-hmm. Healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, of course, Republicans and the president came in. They were going to repeal and replace. Many components of the ACA still remain and are still active. What would you like to see changed? I presume you want to protect the overall aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, there must be some tweaks you might want to see, or what are your priorities there?
Well, right now we need to stop the sabotage that's actually occurring with ACA. So the Republicans were not successful in repealing it, thanks to the leadership of John McCain. They are going along and they're systematically tearing apart the ACA to become so burdensome and so not even useful that people actually want to get rid of it. So they're basically taking away certain protections for pre-existing conditions right now. Mm-hmm. And trying to do it very quietly. They won't pass a bill, but they're trying to sue in the Supreme Court. So first of all, I'd like to reverse all that. But number two, we do need more competition in some of these states in terms of counties. And so what I think we should do for any county that only has one or two insurers, mm-hmm. that we should allow any person to buy into the federal healthcare system. eventually, you know, I do think we have to keep moving forward to universal health care, though. It doesn't have to happen overnight, but slowly we need to start moving in that direction. That's the only way we're going to be able to wrap our whole hands around our healthcare system.
So let me talk foreign policy with you a
sure.
little bit. I want to get your take on the Russia investigation
sure.
overall, what Special Counsel Mueller has been doing. Has there been enough done to make it clear that the job he's doing is important and he should be left alone? Mm-hmm. Has the lack of that given the president more ammunition?
Yeah, so certainly what I have seen so far, especially from the House Intelligence Committee, has been a total lack of courage. The biggest problem, though, is not that you're empowering the president. The truth's going to come out one way or the other. The problem you're doing is you're encouraging Russia to keep getting involved mm-hmm. in our elections because they don't see the consequences of it. And at some point, that fuse is going to run out, and that's where we could find ourselves in a situation that ends up, you know, I think, putting us in a potential war with Russia.
Well, cybersecurity and election security is huge, and so what would defer this idea of war with Russia? Is this allowing Russia to become more aggressive, and that causes us to have to deflect too late in the game?
Correct. So we would be doing either we do an overcorrection or they do a miscalculation. These are, you know, two terms that people use in international relations all the time. You know, that is something that I think would be absolutely unfortunate because we can stop this now. We need to strongly, both Democrats and Republicans, with the president, with the White House, and all of our intelligence committee, need to strongly tell Russia that election interference or any type of interference into our critical infrastructure is not acceptable. I've talked and joined with a couple of Republicans into also having our own offensive cyber capabilities, not just waiting in retaliation, but just to so they know that we have the capability and we're willing to do it. And that's something that we haven't done in the past. And of course, people would be very scared because that creates a certain level of escalation. But from the history of how you deal with Russia, you have to have a tough stance and even a tougher stance in order to keep them away.
If you're reelected, what would you want to see from Democratic leadership? What do you want to see from the party if, in fact, the Democrats get the House back?
Number one, we get the House back. We also, to be realistic, that we still deal with a Republican-held Senate and a Republican-held White House. Now, I think there's a good chance for us actually to pick up the Senate, and so that might change it. But we do need to do some like verifiable actions right away. First of all, right now, there are so many Americans of all ages now that are just drowning student loan debt. We need to have some type of reform to that, whether it's debt forgiveness or allowing people to, you know, to declare bankruptcy. The income inequality in this country continues to grow. We need to tackle criminal justice reform. And with criminal justice reform, we should tackle marijuana legalization. It's time the Democrats take lead on this. We should be for 100% legalization and decriminalization of marijuana, and not just leave it up to states. It should be nationwide and make it like anything else, like alcohol. Above the age of 21, you can use it. Use it responsibly. You shouldn't use it at work. You shouldn't use it while you're driving, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And tax it, of course.
Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego represents Arizona's 7th District. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
When a monsoon storm rolls through, there are really two ways to enjoy the spectacle. From inside, looking out, or right smack in the middle.
I have a small urban jungle farm in South Phoenix.
This is listener Daniel V. Hill, who called in to tell us about his tropical birds.
African grays, cockatoos, lovebirds, and parakeets.
They brace for each storm outside in what he calls his urban jungle farm.
The birds love the monsoon. I'm typically always outside during the rain to kind of assure the birds that, you know, everything's fine. They love when the weather cools down.
Daniel also recently became the proud owner of a pot-bellied pig who got to experience her first monsoon in Daniel's yard.
And she was running around just loving the fact that it was raining.
Thanks, Daniel, for that mental image of a happy pig wallowing in the mud. Today, as part of our monsoon series, we go on a visit to the animal kingdom.
I am Kyle Waits. I work at the Phoenix Zoo as a bird keeper. We are at the Greater Flamingo Yard at the Phoenix Zoo.
22 rosy birds stand like a collection of 1950s lawn ornaments come to life.
Mom, why does that flamingo, why does it go like this?
The birds balance on one foot and stretch their gangly necks, sometimes to honk in each other's faces. And that's Kyle's favorite thing about them.
I love how kind of awkward they are in their social communities and stuff like that.
So describe for us how they eat here, because I'm watching it, and it's like it's almost like with the top of their beaks?
Yep, yeah, they kind of have an upside-down way that they feed. So they will put their bills down into the water, and as you're seeing, they'll sift through the mud, and they have little, they're called lamellae. They're little like hair-like bristles in their bills, which cause them to be able to filter through the muck and stuff and get out the things that they're looking for, like the algae and that brine shrimp.
For wild flamingos, the rainy season equals more food. Kyle says the rain stirs up the mud and brings in fresh water, which causes more algae to bloom. And more food means it's time for more flamingos.
Flamingos actually will kind of do team courtship displays. So they'll walk all together in one line and like do kind of like a little dance together.
After dancing and maybe even dinner, the flamingos settle down. Tell us about these. They look like little mud piles.
Yeah, they look like little mud volcanoes is probably the best way to describe them that I've heard. And so what they'll do is they'll kind of muddle around, and you see the one stamping on the ground there. He's kind of hardening and moving around the mud. And then they'll sand on the nest and gather the mud up around it and kind of just build it up very slowly. The building up and why it's so high is actually to protect from rains. So because they nest during the monsoon season, the waters obviously can rise, so it's a protection for the chicks, so they're elevated from that possible water rising.
It's amazing how powerful the weather is for animal behavior, even for animals that are not outside. The reptile keepers have to mimic the outside world within 1 square foot.
These are really cool. These are one of our native animals. I mean, it's a toad the size of a grapefruit.
Senior reptile keeper James Hall is holding a Sonoran toad that has a permanent frown stretched across its wide face. This little guy lives in a crate with a roommate and a water bowl, but you might come across one while hiking or even in your backyard, especially during monsoon season.
When it rains, they come up. They want that moisture. They lay their eggs in the water. Tadpoles develop very quickly because the water's not there permanently, and then they go back and hide underground.
All sorts of toads and snakes and lizards emerge from their cool hiding spots after a good rain.
Basically, everything revolves around moisture.
So what you're saying is this time of year is not the time for me to go out on a trail.
It's the perfect time to go out on the trail. You will see parts of Arizona that are up and moving that you may never see any other time.
But here at the zoo, these critters are active year-round. Part of that is because the keepers simulate their favorite climate within the tiny enclosures.
So we miss these guys down lightly every day.
Just like we turn on our AC every day. And like the flamingos we heard earlier, love is in the air during monsoon season. But how do you trigger that instinct from indoors?
We would set up a full rain chamber, so we would simulate the monsoons to trigger that breeding. You'll get some breeding, but some of the animals really get that triggered response from the rain. So you set up a shower for them, and they'll take care of the rest.
Okay.
And we'd like to say a big thank you to everyone who has called in to share their thoughts about the monsoon. We really enjoyed hearing them. Keep listening to the show for more monsoon stories as the season continues. We'll keep airing your stories as well. And keep an eye out for those storms. We should see more later this week. Deaths from opioid overdoses continued to rise in Arizona last year. That's according to the most recent tally by the state. This comes close to a year after Governor Doug Ducey declared the rising number of overdose deaths a public health emergency. KJZZ's Will Stone has been covering the fallout from the state's opioid crisis, and he joins me now. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Lauren.
So, Will, you've looked over the new numbers from the state. What did you find?
Sadly, that the final death count for 2017 is even higher than the year before. In total, 949 people died from opioid overdoses in Arizona last year. And that marks about a 20% increase from the year before, Lauren. About a third of those deaths were due to heroin, and more than 40% of those who overdosed had multiple drugs in their system. As you mentioned, for the past year, ever since the governor declared a public health emergency, the states closely tracked overdoses and gathered data to better understand how the epidemic is unfolding in our state. And that's allowed them to drill down into exactly who is overdosing, where they're overdosing, those kinds of details.
Anything stand out?
Some of the trends observed so far, the majority of overdoses occur among men. Overdoses are most common for people between the ages of 25 and 34. And about 40% of those who overdosed had 9 or more opioid prescriptions filled since the summer of last year. Chronic pain is the most common pre-existing physical condition among those who overdose. One at least reassuring note, the powerful, highly potent opioid fentanyl people may have heard about, which has devastated communities really across the country, doesn't appear to have made as much of an appearance in Arizona, although we certainly have had reports of law enforcement seizing large amounts of the drug.
Right. Clearly, an increase in overdose deaths is not a good sign. What are public health officials saying about these new numbers?
That this remains a pressing public health epidemic, and we have clearly still a long way to go as more people die. You know, this is true across the country. Nationally, more people are dying from opioid-related overdoses than did from AIDS at the height of that epidemic, and the skyrocketing number of deaths actually brought down the overall life expectancy in the U.S., according to the most recent figures from the CDC. But despite these tragic and very sobering figures, the head of Arizona's response, Dr. Kara Crist, who leads the Department of Health Services, says, you know, there are signs of improvement.
A lot of the data in this report showed that we are having successes here in Arizona.
So successes, what's she talking about there?
Well, Lauren, since June of last year, Crist's agency reports about a 40% reduction in the number of opioid prescriptions dispensed in the state. Hospitals are referring about 30% more patients to behavioral health services than a year ago. And meanwhile, pharmacies are dispensing more of the overdose reversal drug naloxone than ever before. And there are far fewer patients doing so-called doctor shopping, and that's going around and getting medications from 4 different pharmacies and at least 4 different doctors in the same month. Hmm. So all of these, Crist says, are signs that the state is making some progress.
What about the legislation that was passed earlier this year? Is that any part of this?
It has clearly begun to change the prescribing habits, Lauren, and in general, you know, the awareness among the community. That law, the Arizona Opioid Epidemic Act, which passed unanimously in January, had lots of different provisions, you know, from a Good Samaritan law that protects people who call to report an overdose to ramped up enforcement and oversight of prescribing. A lot of these rules didn't take effect until April, and some haven't even taken effect yet. So they obviously were not going to change the death rate for 2017. The state does have an overall goal of reducing deaths by 25% in the next 5 years. And Dr. Crist says that's still the target.
We did some things like the Good Samaritan law, the referrals to behavioral health that we knew would have an immediate impact, and then a lot of the things have a far-reaching impact in the prevention arena.
And that includes prescribing guidelines for doctors, new pain and addiction curriculum for medical schools and nursing schools, changes in how insurers cover substance abuse disorder, and a prevention campaign for kids in school. There are lots of these ingredients for this public health response that are important, and they're really upstream, meaning we may not see the impact for at least another year, if not longer.
All right. That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you, Lauren.
The Tempe Public Works Department has been roiled by controversy in recent weeks over allegations that 2 of its managers have created an aggressive and hostile work environment. Now, an investigation by the city found that the 2 men violated personnel rules prohibiting abusive workplace conduct, and now one of them has resigned and another has been demoted. Joe Flaherty with the Phoenix New Times has been uncovering it all, and he came into our studios recently to tell me how it all got started.
So employees in the Field Services Division of Public Works, which handles things like solid waste and city vehicles, were complaining with a very wide array of things that they had problems with. And this included allegations of a hostile work environment that included inappropriate language, inappropriate conduct, and kind of general tones of bullying from managers. They were also complaining about the hiring practices in the department. Seemingly, people were being tapped for positions before or during the formal hiring process had kind of really run its course. And there were also some concerns about gender discrimination and retaliation from managers as well.
And how did this all come out? You obtained a report?
I obtained a report that was conducted by two managers from the City of Tempe, a diversity manager and a manager from Human Resources. And they were looking at, just like I said, this very wide array of complaints within the Public Works Department. The investigation that they conducted lasted from December until May, and they produced this 17-page report at the end of it. Now, there was a little bit of a lag time in between when the investigation ended and when I was able to obtain this report. And in that interim, there had been some rumblings of kind of dissent within the Public Works Department from employees who are really interested to see what the outcome of this investigation would be.
Okay, we'll get into that in a minute. But let's talk more about what you found in this report. So this was focused on two people in the higher levels of management here, right?
That's right. And it was looking at the conduct of Tony Miano, who's the deputy director for Field Services within Public Works, and an employee below him, Jason Brown, who was the solid waste manager within the same division. And specifically, employees came forward with allegations about these two men. Tony Miano, employees said to investigators, had a vindictive streak within the department. He was nicknamed the Godfather, or the Godfather of Solid Waste, which employees called him. And he said that he did not refer to him that way when asked by investigators, but saw the nickname as kind of an affectionate one. But nevertheless, employees said that Miano could hold grudges. He seemed to want to tap, quote unquote, his own people when hiring people, sometimes from outside of the city of Tempe. And in general, he just seemed to have the kind of inappropriate language or kind of an aggressive conduct in the workplace. And these were similar for Jason Brown as well, who was the solid waste manager, although employees seemed to take issue with Brown much more in the realm of inappropriate language and bullying. Some employees reportedly did not want to come to work anymore when faced with these certain type of interactions with Brown.
You said the investigation concluded in May, but the city hadn't and still hasn't publicly released it. What took so long?
You know, it's kind of unclear. I only was able to obtain the report through a public records request with the city of Tempe. But it's not quite certain why there was a lag time. The city manager for Tempe, Andrew Chang, emailed employees within Public Works on Friday, and he said that they wanted to do their due diligence when conducting the investigation and finding an outcome. And I should note as well that he also said that they are not able to comment publicly on any disciplinary actions that were taken as a result of the investigation because of employee privacy rules. Mm-hmm. However, just a few sentences later in that email to Public Works employees, the city manager did say that Tony Miano is going to have a new co-manager who's kind of watching over him, a city-appointed person, and that Jason Brown has been placed on leave and he is leaving city employment effective August 17th.
Okay, but Tony Miano is still going to be employed by the Public Works Department and still will be there. Have you heard any rumblings among employees about that, about them being unhappy that he'll still be within the department?
I have heard that. It's a bit of a mixed bag in terms of reaction from employees in the aftermath of these reports that we put out this week. Some people see it as a good first step. They are glad that the report is now out in the open after people asking about it, including in an email that was sent to city council members by a solid waste operator from within the department. But other people are saying that this is the tip of the iceberg, that there are problems within Public Works that go much deeper, and the city is going to implement a corrective action plan in response to this investigation. But I think employees are still waiting for other shoes to drop, perhaps.
Okay, and we'll keep an eye on that. Joe Flaherty with Phoenix New Times. Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
Tucson's 4th Avenue sits right in the heart of the city, full of locally owned businesses in 100-year-old buildings.
So the oldest is Caruso's, over 75 years on the avenue. Some of the newer ones, there's a local arts collective called Tucson Mojo, which just opened. And between there, we have businesses like Silver Sea Jewelry, an independently owned jewelry shop where the owner is in the back room making whatever you want to wear. We have several bars that have been there for a long time, mm-hmm. Shay's Lounge, O'Malley's, Sky Bar.
That's Fred Ronstadt, executive director of the 4th Avenue Merchants Association. But right now, this uniquely Tucson district is facing some change. The Strip's first high-rise is being planned right now, and as we've seen happen recently along downtown Phoenix's Roosevelt Row, where developers see dollar signs, many local business owners and residents see loss. The recent loss of a few longtime favorites along 4th Avenue, like nightclub The Flycatcher, and the new mixed-use apartment tower that's planned, have some calling to keep Tucson weird and wonderful. I spoke with Ronstadt more about this precarious time for the area recently, and he started by telling me more about what makes 4th Avenue special.
Today, it's the largest enclave of locally owned businesses in Tucson and most likely in southern Arizona. There are about 120, 130 merchants. Every single one of them is locally owned. There are a couple of businesses that, there's Dairy Queen, which is a franchise, but the family, the same family has owned that business for over 65 years.
Oh, wow. So even the Dairy Queen's a local and historic business there.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a real community center, right?
It's actually its own culture, and actually I shouldn't even say that. It's reflective of Tucson's culture. It's kind of the place where the community comes to celebrate a lot of things, commiserate a lot of things when there's something that goes on nationally. 4th Avenue is a place where people come down and hold hands and hug and really express their feelings and their joys and their sorrows. It's really a community gathering place.
Yeah. But there have been some notable closures along 4th Avenue in recent years, right? And some announcements of some new developments that are coming. What changes are you seeing there?
You know, it's interesting. I think some of the businesses have, you know, gone through their lifespan. We recently saw Ordinary Bike close. The owner was talking about the fact that, you know, you don't have to go to a bike store to buy a bike anymore. You can just do it online. Mm-hmm. The closure of the Flycatcher is sort of in anticipation of a development that's anticipated to go on the corner of 4th Avenue and 6th Street, which is a mixed-use project, which will have retail on the bottom, which we're fighting to maintain local businesses there, mm-hmm. and residential on top. So we're building up the density of the core, which is a great thing because, you know, it's building more customers for our merchants. But on the other side, it's very scary. Because, you know, change brings with it a lot of uncertainty. And we really want to preserve the culture of 4th Avenue. We want it to be the cool, hip, authentic Tucson experience. But we also are faced with change. And change, as the cliche goes, is the only constant.
Right. So what do you think is behind this kind of change right now? There seems to be a need for housing in the area, but also is it just a sign of the times, this kind of development?
Well, you know, downtown Tucson and the city center has really become a very vibrant and exciting place for people to be and to live. And unfortunately, we don't have the housing stock that's really desired for people who want that urban lifestyle. And so we are seeing a lot of pressure for residential development. And with that, you're going to have to, you know, break a couple of eggs and take some stuff down to build up. Unfortunately, that includes that corner at 4th and 6th where the Flycatcher currently is. Mm-hmm. Now, fortunately for us, 4th Avenue has recently been placed on the National Register of Historic Places. And we have a zoning overlay called an infill incentive district. So there are some protections for the historic nature of Fourth Avenue for a lot, maybe probably over 80% of the buildings are protected. So that's a good thing. And it helps us preserve those important assets that are part of Fourth Avenue. But it also allows for some development in the other areas, so the other 20%. And we're seeing that happen. And certainly we've seen what happened on Mill Avenue. Up in Tempe, and sort of that's the poster child of what we don't want to have happen on Fourth Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's very important for us to take steps to maintain our culture, to make sure that we don't become sort of a corporate ghetto that's not exciting, that's not interesting, that's not part of Tucson.
Right. And you said you're in the middle of fighting for some of the retail space in this one development to remain local. There was a rather contentious city council meeting over the development there. And there were calls to keep Tucson, quote, weird and wonderful, right? Which I think you're getting at here. But what is it business owners, what is it that people are afraid is going to be lost?
I think people, and I don't want to sound overdramatic, but I think it's apropos. People are afraid of losing our soul in a large degree.
Yeah.
We have a very unique community, and there's no other way to say it, but we are a community, and it's of merchants. It's neighborhood folks. We're surrounded by four really nice historic neighborhoods in the heart of the city. People from across the region have a passion for Fourth Avenue. There are stories about first dates or, you know, some celebration or any number of things, including events and people going to the street fair for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So I think when people say, you know, keep it weird, it's really saying, you know, let's continue to celebrate who we are as a community, and Fourth Avenue is that place to do it, and we don't want to lose that. So that's what we're fighting for, and it's truly a balancing act, because you have merchants who are very concerned about losing that uniqueness, and you have other merchants who are like, hey, who wouldn't want, you know, 500 people living right in front of your doorstep?
Right. So you talk about this balancing act. Do you think, though, that this kind of development and growth is inevitable? Do you think that there is a way, as that comes, to really maintain what Fourth Avenue is right now, or is it inevitable that it's going to change?
It's inevitable that it's going to change. If you look at the history of Fourth Avenue, the 100-year history of Fourth Avenue, it's always changing. There are the 75-year-old, you know, stalwarts like Caruso's, but there's the, you know, months-old Tucson Mojo. It's incredibly organic. Change is going to come, and we just need to be very diligent about how that happens. So, you know, that's really the goal. You know, as people come in and they want to build, or they want to modify the buildings, or whatever, you know, a property owner wants to do, we're always there to say, hey, you know, we want to be respected. We want to maintain our culture, and you can very definitely be a wonderful part of that. And we don't want you to be, you know, a destructive force. We want to work with you and make sure that it's a win-win for everyone.
All right. Fred Ronstadt is the executive director of the Fourth Avenue Merchants Association in Tucson. Fred, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Matt G. I am an operations and ice technician. I drive the Zamboni primarily. I call it a glorified riding lawnmower. When I quit corporate America, I went on Craigslist and just happened to see a job posting for an ice rink worker. Well, I was a hockey player myself from the time I was a little kid playing in backyards and ponds. And I remember being in the locker room in high school saying to my buddies on the team, wouldn't it be cool to drive that Zamboni? And here I am today.
That's Matt Grunauer driving a Zamboni at the Ice Den in Scottsdale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, please send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. To say Susan Lasovich did not think she had cancer is an understatement. She'd been told her excruciating stomach pain was the result of constipation. But after another trip to the ER, a specialist told her the pain was actually stage 3 ovarian cancer. Lasovich, who's a longtime journalist and visiting professor at ASU's Cronkite School, wrote about her experience in The Washington Post. I spoke with her recently and asked her what led to her to share this in such a public place rather than on something like Facebook.
Well, it's a great question, Mark, and it's one, however, that I really didn't hesitate on, because while this is a very personal and one could even say a clinical piece, it was something that I wanted to share. I feel that even though I had an unlucky diagnosis with advanced ovarian cancer, I felt that I had extraordinary care. I feel that I was lucky and made some good choices, and I wanted to share that because it is a very emotional time, not only for the patient, but for the people who love that woman. And I want to make sure that whatever news I had that I could share, that I would in the most public way.
So you mentioned that you had good care, you had some luck along the way. I'm wondering how much of the success that you've had, because you're now cancer-free, right?
Well, I am what they call NED, no evidence of disease, but it's only been 8 weeks, and a very jubilant 8 weeks since my last round of chemotherapy. My CAT scan that was done a month later, so a month ago in June, was perfect. But I will be getting regular CAT scans for the foreseeable future.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of the care that you got and the luck that you experienced, I'm wondering how much of that was due to things that you directly did in terms of picking the right physicians and the right courses of treatment and being able to sort of advocate for yourself.
Well, I have to say that doing a lot of research when you have a devastating diagnosis is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you educate yourself. On the other hand, you can scare the living wits out of yourself because there's a lot of bad, scary stuff out there on the internet. The single most influential thing I read came down to one article about an ovarian cancer study done in 2013. There were 13,000 women, and the study found that nearly two-thirds of them got substandard care, which is directly linked to your survival. And among other things, the lead author said, be your own best advocate. This is your life here.
What kind of response have you gotten since this has been published?
Overwhelmingly favorable. For a lot of reasons, and one of them is that I feel that, and this is something I've learned in the process, because ovarian cancer was not something I really knew about until last fall, is that it's kind of a forgotten illness. It's really common. It's the fifth most lethal type of cancer for women, and it's not as organized and as vocal and as militant as something like breast cancer. We all know what PINK stands for. We don't know a lot about ovarian cancer, and it's just a shame because it killed so many women and continues to kill so many women. So I think that any recognition, any kind of crusading for better care is something that is well received in the community.
So now that you've written this, and you know, now that you are certainly more knowledgeable about ovarian cancer than you were before, and perhaps more than you ever wanted to be, do you anticipate continuing to either write about your check-ins or to advocate for better or more advanced care, anything like that?
Yes and no. I really felt like I had something to offer. And so if I feel like I have something to share that is something a lot of people haven't heard of, you bet I'll be publicizing it as well as I can. But I want to encourage women to listen to their bodies, because I did have several symptoms and I did go to my primary care physician a month before I went to the emergency room. I was very laid back about waiting to hear from my doctor. I did not hear from my doctor until I had emergency surgery. I made a couple of mistakes, and those mistakes were pretty grave, because when I went into ER, I had no idea that I had a cyst on my ovary. I would say the last thing that's really important that I learned is that, you know, I'm no Olympian, but I was in decent shape. Decent. I don't smoke. I eat pretty healthy. I'm active. This helped me. This helped me make the choice of going aggressive, having a really aggressive surgery and aggressive chemotherapy.
Do you think the fact that you were so laid back early on led you to be as aggressive as you were when that time came?
You know, that's a great question. I never thought about that. I'll tell you, when a surgeon comes in to your room and the first thing he says is, well, you've got a tumor and we're hoping it's colon cancer. I mean, that is one wake-up call. Now, I still to this day don't know why he was hoping it was colon cancer. Well, I just knew that I was going to fool around. Yeah, I was laid back. So yes, maybe subconsciously that really fueled it. But it was just like being in the trenches. You know, you were just thinking about what you had to do. Fortunately, I was really calm. My family and friends were really calm, and we got through it. And it was only later, you know, after basically I was well into the chemotherapy, that I discovered, you know, I've had problems sleeping at night. And the reason why is I think I was, it was almost like a mild PTSD, thinking like, what just happened? You know, it was a chance for me to really think about actually what went down, because it was so quick. I mean, I went into ER and 1 month later I had that big surgery.
All right. That's Susan Lasovich, a longtime journalist and a visiting professor at the Cronkite School at ASU. She wrote about her experience with ovarian cancer in the Washington Post. Susan, it was really nice to talk to you. I'm glad you're doing well. Thanks a lot for taking the time to chat.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, Mark.
So, Lauren, what you making over there?
Oh, this? I'm just crafting something great for the show.
You sure about that? It looks a little...
Well, you can laugh all you want, but the contestants on NBC's craft show Making It prove that creativity is limitless.
That is true, I will say. Host Nick Offerman and Amy Poehler encourage an entourage of crafty citizens in a competition show. Feels kind of like if the Great British Bake Off and This Old House had a baby.
It's definitely a feel-good kind of show filled with fun challenges, inventive products, and plenty of puns.
Y'all ready for this?
I'm getting sick of your scrapbook.
No way, Crochet.
Don't be spoolish.
I macrame you and I can macro break you just as easily.
Oh, I felt that one.
One of the makers on the program is interior designer Joanna Gick from Chandler. She says she applied for the show on a whim.
I was home by myself. It was late at night. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to apply. So I just applied online. And I didn't hear anything back for several months. I thought, oh, okay, well, I guess that isn't going to pan out.
But she not only got a call back, she made it onto the show. Gick says the entire experience was magical. Even though it's a competition show, she never felt pressure to be better than anyone else.
I didn't feel like I was competing against the other people. I was really competing against myself to see how creative I could really push myself.
And you can see in the show, the competitors are more than willing to help each other out in moments of crisis.
As for hanging out with Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman, Gick says they're just genuinely fun people to be around.
They're so funny together, and they would come around and kind of tease us about little things we were doing, and what's this or what's that, and, you know, we just kind of made light of the whole situation, even though we were, like, under the gun and had only so much time to, like, create something.
You can catch Gick along with Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman Tuesday evenings on Making It on NBC.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.